Summer routines live or die by how easy they are. And honestly, if something takes too much effort, I'm out. That's why Grunes is my go-to. It's my one daily pack of gummies covering my greens, vitamins, and minerals. Plus, it has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, which is more than 2 cups of broccoli. No mixing powders, no giant pills, no hassle. I just rip open the pack and I'm done. They taste good and they make it easy to stay on top of my health, even when life gets busy. Save up to 52% with the code PODCAST at grunes.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS.co.
Go loud. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show will be our usual technique of the week, our culinary conundrums, and joining us in studio is coach, athlete, entrepreneur John Belton, one of your boys, Gaz.
Good friend of mine. Met John a good few years ago now and has been a coach, a friend, a sparring partner, a commie chef for me at times.
Gives you the odd clatter, does he?
He's given me a couple of clatters down through the years, to be fair. Although, to be fair, I think I've given him a few as well. But we'll ask him all about that. He's coming up next.
All right, don't go anywhere. Okay, guys, so it's cooking technique. Talk us through it. What are we doing?
So, technique of the week this week is sautéing. And now, like last week we spoke about, or the week before maybe, we spoke about roasting. And I would say after that roasting, it's probably the next thing that most of us do at home. I mean, we do it in work all the time, but a lot of people do it. And sometimes they probably don't even know they're doing it right. So, it's like a pan frying technique.
Yeah.
But really, when you sauté something, you're taking an ingredient, normally cooking it quite quickly, kind of like stir frying, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's a way that we like wilt down vegetables. So like spinach or cabbage or kale or any of those things can be done really quickly in a sauté pan. It's also the start of most sauces or sofrinos. Or I know Zach or Gary, you've spoken lots in the past about how to make really good tomato sauces.
Yeah.
And you start off that technique at the start by sautéing off your shallots and garlic and some olive oil.
Yeah, like even if it's eventually something that you're going to stew or braise or whatever, there's almost some element of sautéing at the beginning of a lot of techniques. Even
yeah,
a
sure.
roast, you could be sautéing a mirepoix or whatever to put it around your roast.
And I suppose the thing that people need to understand around sautéing, it's all around the controlling of the heat. So like the common mistake that people, sometimes you might read a recipe and it'll say saute with no colour, and like to you and I, we know exactly what they're talking about, right? But to a novice cook or someone that's starting, it doesn't really make sense. Or saute with colour, if you like. So
yeah,
the best example of that is you might be making a white wine sauce and it tells you to saute the shallots with no colour.
That beautiful word, to sweat.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. To sweat down your shallots. So really that's telling me before I even pick up my shallot to chop it up or put my pan on that it's going to be a low to medium.
You spent a lot of time in Australia, and yeah, I know this from America as well, but you very quickly, if you're not the king of the saute pans, you get, there's lots of these sort of high street, highbrow bistros or whatever, you could have 8, 10, 12 pans on the go at one time. Have you experienced a bit of that?
Yeah, I worked in a, when I was in the Radisson in Sydney, we had like a kind of a bistro and the chef had a bit of an Italian flair.
Wow.
And we'd have like a gnocchi dish on, a spaghettini dish, a tagliatelle. So you might have 5 or 6 pans on the go at one time with like all different sauces and different pasta shapes. And really, you learn how to work the pans quick.
Oh, it brings me back to my Devlin's days in Boston, man.
Love
I tell
it.
You. Yeah, yeah. Because like I was right in between Boston College and Harvard Square. I was in a place called Brighton Center. It'd be like a really upmarket, but a quite predominantly Jewish community and Irish community, actually. But everything from doctors, cops, detectives, to college students. And, you know, we would have had all these pasta dishes, but we also had like a half portion thing. Like, so it was like a lobster fettuccine, a chicken fettuccine, and a scallop linguine dish. It was a curried one. And they would have all changed. There would have been 8 or 9 maybe different pasta dishes. minimum. I can still picture now all the stove, my mise en place line, and just my mind goes right back to all them pans going. But geez, you
could
get enough.
Could you still rock the pans?
No problem. But I'll tell you, no problem.
You answered that before I even blatantly asked them.
But you know, over at the K Club, I've got the Palmer, and there's lots of dishes that brings me back. Like, I'm still cooking dishes today that I would have learned in Boston, or I would have brought from Ireland to Boston, or maybe learned some new ones over there. Like, so scattered between the Palmer South and the Palmer North, we have a few of them dishes on the menu up there now. And it's mad how your favourites stick with you through time, and I'm sure the marker is the same for you.
We have a spaghettini dish on the restaurant menu, and it used to be on the bar menu, and I took it off and people were coming and asked me to bring it back. And
yeah,
it's a very simple bisque sauce that we finish with lots of wonderful Irish flake crab meat and some prawns and a little bit of chili oil. It's really, really delicious. But what sautéing in that instant does is it teaches you how to coat the pasta in the sauce and maybe add a little bit of the pasta water to get
the what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear saute? Because I have one in my head, but what's the first thing, like, ingredient wise that comes to your mind when you hear saute that? Will you saute that?
It would be spinach for me.
Oh,
I think, like, sauteed spinach is a side order that's just so
delicious. Onions for me.
Yeah, and onions is, like, it's hard to think of any dish without thinking of onions.
I know.
I mean, they're just, they're nearly in everything.
Jeez, I love onions.
Oh, no, who doesn't?
I know.
Who doesn't? I mean, I now you love turnips. Yeah,
you know, yeah, we've obviously got some listeners at the K Club. You know, Barry Murphy, the comedian, goes, "Hey, where's your turnips today, guys?" Said it to me at the K Club last Saturday morning. I was like, "Oh, you're a bollocks, Barry."
Exactly. Well, okay, that one's going to hang around for a while, I think.
Yeah.
But no, really, when the other little thing I'll talk about, I mean, of course, we could give you recipes, but for sauteing, but I think it's really just the technique that we were talking about.
Yeah.
And then it's that little that comes second nature to us, is where you push whatever the ingredient is, and if you're doing it in a frying pan, down to the back of the frying pan, and you just flick your wrist a little bit. And people think, oh, that's like a showy thing, or it's like someone showing off or whatever, but it's like, if you ever watch a plaster or plaster on a wall, you know, like, they're
therapeutic.
It is, like, it's a skill that you learn. And, like, our job is all around. I mean, we talk about it here every week. It's all about skill and craft, and learning your skill and craft.
Yeah.
And working the pans in a very busy restaurant or a very busy bistro or anywhere is part of learning your craft. And at the start, you keep burning your hand, and you have the thing too hot and too cold and not hot enough. So really, the little bit thing I wanted to say to you was, if you are going to be sauteing something and there's too much heat, the quickest way to remove the heat is to just take the pan away from the heat. And I think if you have a little rack or something sitting beside your stove, if you're worried about your countertops, you just lift it across onto the rack and immediately it'll start to cool down. Once you remove the heat source, it'll start to cool down. So I would say, learning that little technique where you push and flick, you've seen it on all the cookery programs, all the chefs do it. We see it day in, day out in our professional lives. And that's a kind of little technique to kind of move ingredients around the pan so it gets coated.
Well, movement really is the key when it comes to sauteing.
Exactly.
And the movement as well is also keeping that hot point, because when the onion sits, or say it's a spinach, sits in one area for 10 seconds or 8 seconds and moves somewhere else, that somewhere else has been getting hot, and now you're catching that heat, so you're all the time keeping that sizzle going. And really, saute, you think quick, and you think, you know, walks, really, I suppose.
Yeah, like, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, alright, well, that's all said.
Okay, so as we said, we have a good friend of mine in on the pod now today, John Belton. I think Gary gave him a couple of his titles. So from trainer, life coach, John, what else are you calling yourself these days? Entrepreneur, he owns a couple of different businesses, all around good skin. And he might not think I think this about him, but an interesting food story. Because he's taught me to think about food a little bit different, and I don't think I've ever said that to him. Yeah. So, John, you're very welcome. How's it going?
It's going good, lads. I have to say, it's a big privilege to be here with you both.
And you're very welcome.
I don't know who to call chef, because I only know you as chef, but now I've got two chefs that
are... Oh, no, Gaz is a chef as well. And you've also met our producer, Ed Chef. We've christened.
Three chefs in one room. There's a joke.
That's it, exactly. There's definitely a gag in there somewhere.
I suppose, John, I'm nearly best at kicking off in a way. Just how did you two boys meet then?
The abbreviated version of it, I was working in the Marker Hotel gym and Gar came in to train and I got a very quick intro to him as he had his head down, you know, stressed.
Oh, yeah. I'm the boss, yeah.
No, nothing like that. Very brief intro and Roisin, who was working in the Marker at the time, spoke very highly of him and asked me if I'd do some training with Gar as part of our kind of collaboration that we were working there. The Marker obviously were very forethinking at the time and bringing in a whole equilibrium side to the hotel, which involved, you know, a 360 approach to well-being.
What surprised me when I first met you was I wasn't in a very good mindset health-wise. And John never made me feel guilty about that. Or if anything, he pushed me to kind of be more critical on myself. But also was just as critical about telling me to rest and asking me to look at what I was eating, how I was eating, what times of day I was eating at. And I remember he made me keep a food diary for a little while. And I think you said to me at one point, it was the first time anybody ever come back to him with everything in like grams. And, you know, because for me, it was easy to go, oh, 100 grams of beef and 100 grams of venison and 20 grams of this. And he's like, no, the rest of my clients are eating blade venison and
caviar.
Yeah. How much do you talk to your clients about food?
It depends on each client, and every answer when it comes to health and fitness is it depends. And I think that's a really important thing to say, because people want me to give them the template, and there's no template because everybody is so different and everyone's, you know, what's going on in everyone's life is so different. So my job is to take each individual and, you know, add a little bit of salt for one person and cook with olive oil for someone else and add a bit of coconut oil for someone else and go vegan for someone else and learn how to scale it. It's not just a one size fits all. It's like our taste buds and it's like, you know, your art and everything else like that. And I think that's another area that we were able to kind of connect on there. So I would talk to everyone about food on some level when I start with them. And there would be touch points about food at least once a week. But for some people, I would talk about food 6 times a week, 7 times a week. Because it all comes down to where their priorities are, what their goals are, what their capacity for change is and how ready they are to change. Food is, you know, sleep underpins everything. That's the most important thing from a health point of view. And everything I talk about would be have a bias towards, you know, living.
Has that always been the case, or is that, are you learning more about that as you're going through your career?
No, it's...
Did you always know it was that important?
I always knew it was important, but my realization of things has changed. I'm 20 plus years at it now and I've over 100,000 PT sessions under my belt. And like, if you're not sleeping, nothing good happens. Now I have a 10-month-old, I know all about it myself on a different level.
You just took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say, like, just off air before we came on, you mentioned about the Bambino being 10 months old. I was going to say, like, have you seen a huge difference in your own life with regards to sleep, being able to get it on demand, or
being honest, I haven't. And everyone wants me to, you know, I've just managed, I've adapted. I suppose when you work for yourself, adapting to things is just what you do every single day. And like, if someone said, God, do you notice a massive difference? I truly don't. The difference I notice is that I don't have time to go and sit somewhere and have a coffee and look at a wall for 40 minutes if I feel like doing it. That's gone, and that's okay. Sleep, I've always been up 4:30, 5:30, somewhere around there to train people. So sleep deprivation is something I'm okay with. That doesn't mean that it's a good thing, but you know, if I have to go through a period of it, that's all right. I'm very good at, maybe it's compartmentalizing, I don't know, but putting things into little going right, you know, I've got a 10 month old now, sleep is getting better. I knew 10 months ago I was going to have 12 months of it, and that was in my head. And once I've got goals and expectations managed for myself, that's okay. I can deal with discomfort for extended periods of time. That bit's fine. You know, but it's been great. Like every event that's happened in my life, whether it's setting up a business, whether it's getting older, whether it's my hair falling out, or whether it's, you know, not being as easy to lose weight, whatever that is, for every little thing that's happened in my life, it's just added to me as a coach. And that's, you know, there's been tough things that have happened at different stages, and it's just added to me as a coach that I've learned. So to answer your question, yeah, having a Bambino now makes a difference. I can possibly relate to people a little bit more. But, you know, probably one thing I struggle with is feeling, I don't want to sound like bad, but I'm feeling sorry for people when they start saying, oh, well, like, I just think you need to find a solution to something. There's always a solution. And if we focus on the fact that I'm deprived of sleep, my training is adapted. I don't lift as heavy. I work off the clock all the time now at my training. So instead of sitting there, because, you know, it can drift, I'll do everything on the minute and I'll record my times and I'll do that sort of stuff, so that my training now is different. But I feel like I'm probably as fit as I've ever been. you know, and all that sort of stuff. So it's all about adaptation.
Yeah, and is it gyms that you own, or do you go to clients, or are they all coming to you, John, or is it varied?
So at the moment, I have a gym on Upper Hatch Street. We work out of the Marker Hotel gym as well. I do corporate work within a number of different companies around the country. I'm actually based currently in Portugal, so I work online. I train people on Zoom all over the world, the States, Dubai, Russia. They're just Zoom appointments, and I train people in their homes as well. And there are people who pay me to train them for the year and look after their family for the year. And that's everything from dealing with liaising with their doctor, looking at what's happening with their bloods, going through their house, looking at how they cook, what sort of foods, working with people.
Bloods
with
tell us the real story. Yeah.
The bloods are part of it. And I think, you know, I encourage everyone to start taking their bloods when they're not sick, because what happens is people tend to go and get their bloods in when they're sick. And now you've got, you know, you don't know where you were before. And it's like the way that it's not a one size fits all. If your bloods were, you know, if you'd heightened, like I've been taking my bloods for 15 years and I've, you know, like slightly elevated ferritin perhaps or something like this. But if I went in and got my bloods in now, they would say it was too high, whereas it's always been around the same level. And it's good. It's like your passport. You want to just know where it's been. So yeah, working on all that things, you know, that's what I truly love. I love being able to go in to someone's home and when they want to be the healthiest versions of themselves they can be and for their family, and just kind of talk. Like one guy I speak with, he has a chef in the house, all that stuff. And that's, you know, that's really the...
Yeah, it's really? All, well, when you get them kind of clients, it's always handy, because I've just come back from a private chateau for 5 years, and so many of my clients come in, like they would have traveled with their own, you know, their own coach. Some of them would have even had their own chef as well that would have just joined us then or whatever. But the one thing that was very uniform with almost all of them was that they nearly all had coaches, you know what I mean? Like it's, they really do look after themselves, you know what I mean? It's the wealthiest people.
But I think to perform at any type of a level, like you really have to, and that's kind of what I learned when I started with all of this, because at the time I was... When I took John on as a coach, I also took on a business coach, and I was speaking to a psychologist, and because I was just trying to do too much, I had too many balls up in the air, and I was just taught by just grunt was going to get you through out the other side. And it did take a lot of grunt as it turned out, but it also...
But a strategic approach is all...
Yeah, you had to step grunt, you had to step back.
Yeah,
for sure.
Strategic grunt, for sure. Yeah.
And growing up, John, what did food look like? Now, I know the answer a little bit to this, but for the listener, you're from Wicklow.
Yeah, food. I was thinking about this last night, about 2 o'clock in the morning when I couldn't sleep. So nervous coming in here. Food for me has always been about fuel. And like I grew up with a shortage of food in the house, truthfully. My dad worked very, very hard, but, you know, there was five of us. So there wasn't always a lot to go around by the end of the week. My grandfather would have planted potatoes in his back garden, which we would have picked every year. My mum always planted, you know, peas, beetroot, different things like that, which we would have picked every year. We would have had a pet lamb the odd time that got sent off to be slaughtered every year. We had chickens that we ate. So growing up for me, I feel like a lot of people now, if you look at what's happening in the States, they're trying to set up, I think they call them homesteads or whatever it is, where they're, you know, living off the land and doing stuff like that. And in a lot of ways, I grew up that way. My family, I grew up in Roundwood, up in the highest village in Ireland, and a lot of our family would have been farmers and stuff like that. So we would have often had someone would come to the house and give you a turnip or give you a bag of potatoes or do something like that. You know, and I didn't know any different, but as I look back...
I'll tell you in a minute what we're all at.
Okay, man. Okay.
There's an in-house joke about a turnip. As soon as you said turnip, I said... Okay. I'll tell you about it later. Go on,
tell me that one after. Okay. So... I mean, when I look at what food meant, food was a very, you know, and I do think that food is bigger than just a meal. It's a huge
community
part. Yeah. And it was a community thing, and it was a case of...
Sounds very like my upbringing. Yeah,
yeah.
It was. It was the same. I mean, it was second nature. We have this thing, like in Eurotalks and organisations we're involved in, with boys buying local. And like I've been seeing it all my career. I'm like going, well... What other way do you buy food? What other way is there to buy food or grow food or do whatever? Because it's such second nature. Also, if you had grass,
if you're like me from Dublin, I mean, I can't even remember the first time I was on a farm, but I was definitely well into my teens,
Yeah.
Maybe as a kid, I was in a farm at school or whatever.
I was growing.
No real memory of it.
I was
dropping in with.
A turnip.
Bleeding turnips, man. Yeah.
I'll try to get this turnip joke out of you. Yeah. Every time I say turnip.
Yeah, well, it's the only way you get an appreciation for a turnip is when you actually grow it yourself. Yeah, over the years. Then you might understand where the love comes from.
Sure. I mean,
but, and it was very homely cooking. Like, your mum has cooked for me, so and she's a very, very good cook. So,
yeah.
Like, it was.
I can even picture what was in your plot. You definitely had scallions. You definitely had onions. You definitely had cabbage. Yeah. It was easy growing.
Carrots.
You had carrots and definitely turnips. And only the odd time, maybe turnip, but you always had spuds.
Always.
Yeah, always spuds.
But you like, you and your brothers and your sisters as well were so into fitness and training and fueling that side of it.
Yeah.
How did you just get around that when, or was it just eating just solid cooking?
I mean, you're eating well.
Truthfully, when we look back, you know, the produce that we got like versus now, and I've, you know, been into the States and been on, you know, nutrition courses where there's guys talking about grass-fed this, grass-fed that, and I'm like, Jesus, is all meat not grass-fed?
Is
there something else to it? It is.
What else do you eat?
So we realised, the more global I went, the more I realised how lucky, and even now living in Portugal, I realise how lucky we are to have such amazing produce on our doorstep and good quality stuff. And I think quality underpins everything else, you know, really like good quality fish. Unfortunately, that fish has deteriorated in quality by such a large amount and all the rest of it. So it was difficult probably for us to eat healthy and eat the right amounts of what we were eating, and we probably weren't doing it, but I do think the stuff we were getting was so good. It was potatoes, meat and veg.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a big dinner.
Eggs and dairy or whatever.
Exactly. Oh, eggs, dairy.
Raw milk.
All raw milk, definitely. Yeah. My uncle has a dairy farm, so we'd get dairy from there the odd time, you know, and that really was the nuts and bolts, like a bowl of cornflakes for breakfast because it was on the cheap, and that's just the way it had to
Did
be.
Did you play football growing up, or were you more athletic?
Played Gaelic and a bit of athletics, a lot of long distance running and stuff like that. And then as I got a bit older and I started to drift away from the village, I used to box in Bray with Pete Taylor.
Yeah.
You know, and then I started working in a Westwood gym when I was 16 and started into weight training and all the rest of that. But food, to come back to it, my mom was a great woman for getting us involved in cooking, and you know, at the time it was a pain, but like now as I meet friends who haven't a clue how to fry an egg, I just can't get my head around this. Her whole thing about it was, you know, when they're standing there peeling carrots and potatoes, she could ask us questions because we weren't looking her straight in the eye. We'd be distracted peeling a carrot. My mom would be finding out if I was after actually getting a dig in the head or giving a dig in the head or what happened last night at football. My mom also was my GA coach, so she knew a lot of what was going on, and she was fueling us up and doing all the rest of it. But I work with a great coach in the States, a guy called James Fitzgerald, and he spoke about something called food hygiene, and not in the cleanliness state. Food hygiene in his world was the 360 approach to what food was. Everything from how we chew our food and don't force water down with it, not have a phone on the table, sit around as a family, right down to preparation of food and what, you know, someone who, it might sound a bit cheesy for this room, who loves you enough to prepare a meal for you. You know, if you know that there's someone who's cooking a meal for you and something like, you know, that in the bigger picture of your health and what health means, that's a very important part of it. And, you know, I would have thought that was a bit woo-woo a few years ago, but now as I look at like what, and I look at my mom still like cooking up for eight or 10 people at a time, no matter how many people comes in the door, she seems to find something to cook.
Put on the table.
Yeah, and I realise how big a part of our life food was. And although there was never caviar on the table or a wine or anything else like that, the food that was there was always very lovingly prepared. And and I think that healthy relationship with food has been something that has stood to me then, where I've never looked at food as something that I'd have to have an excess of sugar for this, that or the other. It was always something that was a fuel for energy and exercise, but a fuel for like just vibrant life.
It's funny you say that, you know, like Mammy gave up a great job in the civil service, and my older brother, he's a year older than me, like, but whenever he was born, Mammy just didn't want anybody else rearing her kids, so she gave up work. And I mean, as the years went on, I'd look back and say, geez, like, you know, she'd be retired now on a phenomenal pension and whatever else, you know what I mean, but then live a really happy, brilliant life. But I remember being at school, and like, we had different dinners, Gareth and I have often talked about it here, John, you know, and I'm like going, all right, today, like, it's today's veg soup day or whatever, like, and then the beef and the bone, the broth would be like a Scotch broth with beef, and another day would be like, this is fish day and so on, and bacon and cabbage day. But I used to feel sorry for some of my buddies. I'd be like going, oh my god, imagine, like, they're going home, like Liam's going home and he won't get a dinner at 7 o'clock because my whole day, everything evolved around
the grub.
When you get off the school bus and your horse, and there's about a quarter of a mile to the house, whatever. And I just like, you're just like an animal. I'm like going, I'm fucking starving. You know what I mean? But we went into that house. Just you said there, if one of my uncles landed or my cousins landed, I used to be raging on different days. I'm like, oh, this prick's landing now. He's going to want one of me chips or a bit of me fish or whatever. I was like, how'd you know like the dinner would be ready? He goes, it's the same time every day. So, you know what I mean? And I'd be pissed off, you know what I mean? But it was such a welcoming home, our house. And it's only now when you're older and you appreciate like just how much of a legend Mammy and Daddy was, you know what I mean? Because then she did go back to work later on. Yeah. And he, for somebody that played stupid enough for minis of years, was able to turn out an old dinner himself. Like, you know what I mean? But it was brilliant to go home, and that's why now, like at our house, you chat there about the phone being away. I mean, I was like, oh, geez, there's a few things I am doing right.
Country boys, fairly simple living.
But no one
robbing cars. Or doing any bad luck.
Yeah, but like,
and where did you learn to hot wire the car? Why didn't you know that? Oh no, actually.
Or siphon petrol. Yeah. Oh, the taste of that.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
And come here, you're not like, what I kind of see now, a lot driven by social media, is this, pardon the pun, appetite to look a certain way. Mm. Or, you know, and I mean, I'm obviously very mindful of it now. I have two teenagers who you know both of them, exactly 16, just turning 17, and Georgia is 14, turning 15. And like, both of them are very active in sports, and I talk to them a lot about how they eat. And from the knowledge that I've learned and educated myself, a lot of it through you and also through myself. Mm-hmm. But aesthetic is really, I would say, a lot of people that come to you aren't coming to you for all-round wellness, or maybe they are, but they want to lose weight, I would say. Yeah. And is that achievable, or is that a good space for people to
It's like, I think the thing about it is, a lot of the issues that we're experiencing now, whether it's, you know, from a health point of view, storing body fat, in my opinion, is another symptom of a problem. Okay, the problem is excessive stress. Now, if someone comes to me and they've got dry skin or joint pain or some sort of female health related issue or some sort of men's health related issue or whatever else it is, it's a symptom of a problem again, which is stress related. So my job is getting to the bottom of that stress, helping them find that out and resolving that. Now, a lot of times when people come in, they're storing body fat, and that's very aesthetic, and that's enough for them to go, I can't look at myself in the mirror because of this, or my belt buckle unfastened, or whatever that is. So that then, you know, that's the catalyst for change. But when we get there, we realise that there are other symptoms there, but we tend to ignore these symptoms. They're like amber lights flashing in your car. And it's not until the red light goes on, which is something where you become, you know, self-aware, self-conscious about that, that people will start change. So storing body fat, this is a long-winded answer to your question, but storing body fat is a symptom of a problem. And once we start addressing the underlying issues, the body fat tends to be resolved as a result of that. Working on sleep, working on underlying things, blah, blah, blah. Now, what we do see is that the pressure that's placed because of what we're seeing from an aesthetic point of view has become a bigger and bigger issue. There's no question about it. You know, but to be honest, when I was growing up and training in the gym, like, there was no one around had a six pack. Nobody, you know, it just wasn't the case. It is like, I saw Zach the other day. He's you know, 6 foot, whatever it is, and built like a whatever, you know, as well. There's definitely been a massive shift from lack of knowledge about training to now, how can I get my six pack up to an eight pack, sort of carry on. When I started training people, the first week of training, first 10 days of training was teaching them how to squat. And people would squat and it was like this foreign thing that they'd never seen or heard of in their life. I remember saying, no, we're going to do a squat. And they go, what's that? And I go, how do you not know what a squat is? And that's 85, 90% of clients. My first session with a client now is, okay, let's see how you squat and see if I can improve it. So like, everything has opened up, everything has changed, and that there's loads of pros to that. Definitely,
we've how do you poach an egg?
Yeah.
But it's net. You know, we could also argue that for every person who's gotten really fit and really healthy and all the rest of it, there's five or six people who've unfortunately became obese on many levels and are getting, you know, sicker, fatter, and sadder, as the book says. So the aesthetic thing, to answer your question, Gary, is something that I think people are putting a lot more pressure on themselves about. But I do think the people that are coming to me, the pressure's gotten to a stage that they want to see change, and they're seeing the change, and they're achieving. Their standard that they've set for themselves is a lot higher. You know, and I suppose in cooking terms, people would fry up an El Sirloin steak, whereas now people want to have their slow cooker out and they want to season it and they want to do all that because they've been exposed to it and they've seen it on social media and they know that it's attainable. So people now go like, I don't just want to drop a few pounds. Like, I want to look like a very in shape 40-year-old.
Can I just go back to stress there? We had a guest on just last week too that talked about his dad and his high pressure job and stress, and it led to 3 or 4 different heart attacks. Like, but anyway, he ended up finding a way to get away from work, lived another 28 years by changing stress. Do you see stress in the physical form? Is that a reason why people can carry weight or hold weight, or is it just because stress directs them down bad eating habits to try and make themselves feel happier?
That's a good question. And in my world and in my way, when I assess people, I speak about 3 different types of stress. I speak about chemical stress, physical stress, emotional stress. You've probably heard me waffling on about this. So to summarize, chemical stress could be the air we're breathing that's not clean and healthy, living in a moldy house with a lot of dark mold in it. It could be anything like that. But also, as I'm sitting with 2 chefs, the foods we're consuming, how they're cooked, how, you know, the quality of the food we're consuming, the quality of what our food consumed, all of these things, you know, that's chemical stress. Physical stress, lack of movement, lack of exercise, chronic pain, nerve impingements, right down to, you know, old injuries that people have had and they've carried and they hobble around with it for 20 years. Then emotional stressors would be like a lack of purpose, not feeling fulfilled in your job, relationship stressors, anxieties, mental health related issues. They're all different types of stress that come under that create the exact same chemical response in your body, where your hypothalamus, pituitary and adrenal gland, it's what produces our stress hormones, etc. They become dysregulated as a result of chronic stress. So I don't think the problem for people is, you know, the big scare that they might get or the lad who pulled out in front of them in traffic and they kick off. I think the dangerous thing that we're all living is this 1% of stress. It's the wave that's constantly hitting the shore and erodes it over 20 years. You know, and in a room full of men all in our mid-30s, you know, we've had 30 plus years of that small level of stress. And all of a sudden then we go to the doctor and the doctor goes, geez, you've got high blood pressure. Or we wake up and go, all of a sudden I'm hanging out of my trousers. Or we wake up one day and we're sad. And this is what I'm seeing with people all the time. So these stressors, they all have the same impact on our bodies. They all have, because it's a chemical thing that slowly, you know, the slow drip feed of that causes problems slowly. And it's called a stress cascade. It starts at one area of our body and just keeps cascading. And then one day we wake up sick because we've neglected the amber lights. My goal is to bring people back through those amber lights and clear and tick them off so they never see the red lights. That's my goal.
I'd say one of the biggest things for people is time, the lack of time, especially with families and work, cost of living.
I mean, I think that's probably the biggest excuse.
Well said.
Easy to say that though.
But I think, and this is why I like John's approach, and this is why he's been in my life, and so has most of his family, because, you know, it's very easy to try and put a lot of roadblocks in the way, but having a much more holistic approach to your wellness, and that's what I like about John's business model. That's what I like about the other people that work within his business. It's not about trying to get you to train for 2 hours every day, because that's unrealistic. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of trainers, an awful lot of them out there, and all they focus on is your shoulders getting bigger, your stomach getting leaner, you're getting that V shape, and torturing yourself to get there through food, through exercise, through unachievable. In my view, there's loads of them. I mean, John, you know how many of them are out there, where your approach has always been to look at the full rounded approach. And if I ever said to him, John, I just don't have the time, he'd be like, I'll just stop you right there. Right, let's have a look at your day. Mm. You telling me you can't squeeze an hour into your day of like a bit of movement that mightn't be as much as you wanted it to do. And, you know, John and I and his brother Kevin and his other brother Liam would have kept each other honest. And I remember like someone at John's pro athlete level, nearly, that's the way he trains, saying to me, geez, you text me this morning and you trained. And I was like, right, I have to train now because there's a circle of us that keep each other in check.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what I've learned about fitness, that entering into a community of like-minded business people and keeping each other in tow. And they'd ring me and go, Gar, look, I'm not getting enough food in. You need to teach me a few little techniques. Yeah. And Kevin's I bought them all pans and knives and
spices.
You know, and taught them little techniques to. Because I think that's the other thing that people get really wrong when it comes to nutritious, healthy food, if you want to use that stupid word. But it's about like getting a bit more flavour into what you're doing, and then it won't be as monotonous as overcooked broccoli and overcooked chicken. And
I think you touched on some really important points there. Like, the people I work with are people who want to achieve, so in a way it's a lot easier for me because like, you know, the guy or a pro athlete or someone who's directing a business like a large accountancy or legal firm, like, they're driven people, okay? But what you'll find is, you know, there's a great line, success leaves a trail. So successful people have the right people around them, you know, and they don't let the wrong people into that circle. And the right people around them, they're all in the gym at 6:30 in the morning. They're all beside each other, you know, or they're texting each other, they're motivating each other. They've been through the highs and the lows, and they know what's needed. And I look at you guys, like, I call you corporate athletes, because the needs and demands that high-charging corporate individuals place themselves only differ in type to the needs and demands that high-charging athletes place in themselves. Mm. So if Gar Mullins is in front of, you know, X amount of chefs and customers, clients, and, you know, companies coming into, et cetera, and he's looking fatigued and tired and he's slurring over his words and, you know, not looking fit and healthy, that's a representation of himself. And if a pro athlete goes out like that onto a rugby pitch, for example, and does it, they'll get ran over very quickly and they'll get neglected and dropped. So you need to, you know, when I talk to someone like Gar, and Gar is like, I want to work, you know, 27 hours of the day. I'm going, if you want to work 27 hours a day, you got to, your body is your machine, and you got to treat it like a machine, like your Harley Davidson. You won't leave it out in the rain. You'll fuel it up. You'll change the sprocket and you'll look after the tire. And if you do that, you'll be able to get the mileage out of it. But if you don't do that, something breaks. And look, the truth of the matter is that there are people who don't understand that. Yeah. And unfortunately, then they have to run into the wall a couple of times. And then they'll come back to it and go, okay, how do I do this differently? And how do I, you know, to be the best version of yourself, you can't pour from an empty jug. You have to really look after yourself so that you can be the leader, dad, whatever it is that you want to be.
How are you feeling now, Gary?
Well, I hate to bring it up, but there's only one of us here, a marathon runner.
No.
It's not this mess over here.
I was wondering how long it was going to be before he was going to tell you
I kind of wanted to talk about it in the first few minutes.
The first series, he must have brought it up about 15 times that he's...
I did not.
I'm joking. No, but Gary, you have somebody that's drifting in and out of training.
I'm in, out, in, out, and out.
And you've just lost quite a bit of weight.
Out more than in, But, yeah, look, it was always... The thing with me, though, is that... When I trained, I remember all the years I played or whatever, never the best player on the team, but easily the fittest. Like I had a machine mentality, same to work as it is to training, to everything, probably in a way like you, like, you know, it was, endurance was always my gift, I suppose. Like, but again, like mise en place, going back to it, whenever I was at it and playing, like, I got a bad injury that stopped me playing football. And there's no point, and my wife listens to the pod, she'll be rolling her eyes now if she's listening to this, but it affected me so much. Mm. Never, even, you know, the days of teams all finished, but going back to Donegal and doing Astro or doing I cannot even begin to tell you how much I miss it. Like, it just... When there was no football at the end of any kind of training or any kind of, even when you're into over 30s and you know, you weren't in the first team anymore or whatever, you still knew that when you went home on a couple of Mondays or Tuesdays, such a group, I went to go see my brother. He would have played Astro on a Wednesday. He'd say, look, I'll go see him on Wednesday because I'll join the boys. It's amazing how much you miss that. But then nearly everything went off a cliff. Mm. So I ended up training for a few marathons and running them only because with the injury I had, running in a straight line was all I could do. Mm-hmm. And I got nothing from it.
Mm-hmm.
I crossed the finish line of Dublin Marathon. I was like, what a load of shite.
Yeah, no, I can.
Honest to God, I was just like, well, that was just fucking a load of nonsense.
No, I mean, I think what that shows you, though,
I feel like I must have been the only person in the world in a marathon. No, am I not? Yeah, well, probably am. But I honestly thought
there are other people in the world that have ran marathons.
Well, I figured you would have ran it, but I was giving him the gym and Ed Sheff over there. Don't think you're out of this out of the huddle either.
I drive a marathon every day.
Yeah, but I mean, it. I was surprised at how little.
Yeah,
it did for me.
I think it's down to your expectations on something, and I did my first marathon was in Connemara.
Yeah,
and I remember getting in the car afterwards, going,
"What was that all about?"
I never got the high, I never got the endorphin rush. And I went, "Okay, fine," but I guess you know your association with exercise is you know team sport, group of lads, you know the camaraderie, the group on a mission, perhaps achieving something together, and you know that drove you and pulled you forward. And if you're trying to look for that again, you're not going to find it. Way you're not going to taste that exact same steak you tasted 20 years ago that had X, Y, and Z on it. That's gone. But if your expectation, you know, if you can manage your goals or set goals and set a purpose to what you're doing, it changes it. So your capacity to feel good from exercise is still there. You just need to learn how to rewire your brain for that. You know, you need to adjust your taste buds to perhaps strength based stuff or to perhaps, you know, high intensity sprints on a skier and a machine. So really, you know, and that's where a coach comes in, and a smart coach goes, okay, look, I get that you enjoy that. And if you wanted to get back to that, perhaps, you know, there is some way now, science has changed, the medical world is that better, maybe you could get back to five-side, and to do that we need to get you back running. Now all of a sudden running has a new purpose for you, and you know there's a bigger picture to it. But look, the reality is that it shows the impact, the mental impact or the stress of a trauma, you know, and a trauma changes our trajectory massively. So the trauma for you was your injury, and your injury, you know, your exercise, the role of what exercise was for you in your life was taken away straight away. You weren't ready to go. I'm going to just step back from that now. And when something's taken away from us, there's a trauma response to that. So, you know, when you then exercise again, you're looking for that feeling and it disappeared and it was gone. So, of course, your expectation was wrong. But if you could manage expectations in a different way and understand what your goal was from it, your experience of something changes. You know, our experience... and come back to a meal, like if someone told you about this meal somewhere and built it up and hyped it up and you went in then with their expectation for it, you may not have the same experience. Whereas which happens all the time. And that's like when someone tells me about a film, I'm like, don't tell me about it. If it was good, build it up for me, because if you build it up and then I'm going to go, it was a bit of an anticlimax. You know, how many times you go to the cinema to watch some random film and go, genie, that was brilliant. Because you had no expectation for it and you just went in neutral. So if you can...
The big runs that you've done a couple of years ago, I don't think I told the lads about that, but you competed some like ultra human runs. Like, what was that one you done in the ice?
I did 250k in the Arctic Circle, and that was it's called a stage race. It's done over 5 days, and I did 200 and I think it was 35k in the Amazon last year in the jungle. That was 5 days. Well, they're self sufficient.
And was there a huge sense of achievement at the end of them? Surely.
There's a sense of achievement, but. I left my ego at the door, and I don't mean this in a cocky way. I always knew I was going to complete them, and I always know, like,
how did you know that? Just there was enough work done there.
It doesn't matter if my leg's hanging off, I'm going to complete it.
Okay, yeah.
Now, as it happened on the first one, I got COVID day one, so I'm in the Arctic Circle, it's minus 40 degrees. You get a frost nip on my nose, my hands got frost nip, my eyelid froze closed. I cramped for 34 kilometers on my own in the middle of the Arctic Circle. There's a guy getting a helicopter airlifted out of it, like it was full on. You know,
great crack.
Yeah, but like there's a great line. And you two boys laugh now, but I guarantee you, if you got a taste for it, you'd understand it. There's a guy who did one of them one time. I was watching a YouTube video about these races, doing my research on it, and someone said, why did you do it? And he just went, to find the edge. And I was like, to find the edge? And I was like, oh, I kind of get what you mean. And when you do a race like that, in my opinion, I don't do it to go, I've achieved it, and I'm a great person. I can complete this.
Well, you definitely want to do it. Like, the only thing I would tell you, like, I mean, jokes aside about running marathons, but the first thing I did after doing it was like going, right, well, that was a load of shit. What would make it better?
Yeah.
And I was like going, I'd run the Great Wall of China.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a Great Wall of China. So, like, right away when you say it, I was like, right, well, I need to fucking put some seasoning on that.
Yeah, because
that was
it.
That, like, was boring. You know what I mean?
The thing about a multi-stage race, the more extreme that race, and the more, and this is where people do get hooked on it, marathons, and possibly why you didn't, because when you get to a level where you reach what your threshold is, and then you overcome that, that's growth, okay?
Yeah.
So now people think threshold means how fit you are, but when you're doing an ultra marathon and you're cramping up and you're on your own and you've got frostbite and there's people dropping around you and you have to crap in the snow on the side of the
you
thing.
You probably enjoyed it.
No, I enjoyed meeting the person that had to overcome
that got out of it. That's what I mean by that.
And that's what growth is. So, like, so that's addictive in a sense because, you know, I learned, like, the person who started the race 5 days later was a completely different person finished the race because, you know, day one, 5K into it, I started cramping. I was like, first checkpoint's at 20K and I'm out of this. I can't beat this. I was walking along going, you know, crippling along in the middle of nowhere. And worried I wasn't going to get to the checkpoint. Got to the checkpoint, but what actually happened was this Italian ultramarathon runner, a really good guy who was ahead of me, I caught up with him about 500 metres from the checkpoint and he was crouched down like this with diarrhoea, face completely covered in snow and frost, beard frozen. I helped him up, got him into the tent, and he got into the tent and he blacked out, collapsed. I turned around to the medic and went, flip out cramps. And he went, hey, give a couple of Panadol and get the back out.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. Yeah. And then they called in a chopper. I see the chopper flying in then a kilometre or two later to lift your man out.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so that was 20. I went for another 15K where I was hobbling along. I had to come up with a strategy. So my strategy was the course is marked out 50 to 100 metre mark. Every 50 to 100 metres there's a red mark, red flag. And I went, I'm only going to go from this red flag to the next one. I'm going to try if I tried to run, it would kick me and I'd get this cramp and I'd have to stop. Now I was whacking electrolytes and taking Panadol, doing all the right things, but it just wasn't going away. So then I go, right, I'll run for 10 steps in between each one. Yeah. Next one, I'll run for 20 steps. Okay, I'll run for one, I'll run for two, I'll run for... And this is what, you know, this strategy then got me in. And day one, I came in, I was like in 15th place, but got through it. And I went, okay, I don't know how I'm going to get through day two. But day two came out, same strategy, and then my knee got sore and I was like, God, my knee's gone here now, I'm going to have to stop. And I went, no, you're not, come up with a strategy, get around it. Day three, stomach was wet, turned on me, but every day there was something I just realised on day three.
It's mad how you give yourself little trigger points though, and all my training, like, because I'd done it for the first year I was training was when I tore the cruciate, so I trained for a few and then ran one, but I'd been up to 20 miles in the training 2 years. But say I had a 16-mile run on a training Saturday, I always did my big runs at 6 a.m. on a Saturday. But when I would get to 8 miles, once I got to 8 miles on a 16-mile run, I was downhill in my head. Even if I was going up a hill, I was like, I'm on the way home. I'm on the way home. Because I would do a loop, and I was like, right, 9, 10. So it was literally like from 8 to 16, I was running downhill. I just programmed my head. I was like, the goal was always the halfway point because the rest of it's easy. And then all of a sudden the miles just keep clocking up. I mean, it's an unbelievable place to get there when you're that fit, you know.
As a man who finished a marathon and went, what the fuck was that was all about?
Yeah.
Can you not see?
But I enjoyed the training.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed the training. I didn't enjoy the marathon. I did not enjoy it. I really enjoyed it.
Listen to this piece. Like, how many, let's say you did a 12-week training program. So you 12 weeks of something that you
really enjoyed.
That's what I did. I did the marathon for mortals.
Yeah.
One of the training things at the back of that. But the training, I was in an absolute machine.
I don't know if you can hear yourself, just so you know.
But
there you go, when you go, what the fuck's the marathon all about? And that, and you just answer that question there now.
Yeah.
And is that, you know, it is about, like, as Jesus ends, it's about it's not about the actual destination, it's about the journey to the destination. Yeah. And it's about,
it's more fun.
Yeah. Well, it's not even about the fun. And, like, if you're someone who's into being the best version of yourself you can be as a chef or as a business person or anything else like that, you understand that process is where all the magic happens. You don't wake up one day with, you know, all of these accolades as a chef.
Yeah.
You go through the pot washing, and then you go through to the spud peeling, and then you go through to the omelette making, and all of a sudden then you've... And that's where the
Have you seen people's approach change to food, John, in the last...
Yeah, massively, massively. Again, people didn't know. Like, education's huge, and, you know, the more I tried in the past to sort of go, you can't have this, you must have that, that never worked. So I understood that going...
People, I'd say, just lie to you all the time as well. Of course they did, yeah. The food.
Of course
they did. Oh, did you have that can of Red Bull? No.
No, God, no.
Oh,
no.
Jesus, no.
I remember a lady...
Yeah.
I remember asking a lady, like... Because as a young coach, young chef, we go in and go, and my way is the only way to do this. And I remember learning from this lady, she's actually a psychologist, and I used to sort of go, now this, you have to eat this. And she was like, I think I'd get on better because I know my personality. If you said to me, will you tell me what you're doing so that we can work on it? And I went, okay, we'll try that. And she wrote down the next day that she had a box of ice cream Mars bars. And I was like... How does someone eat a box of ice cream Mars bars?
Yeah.
It's like, you can't do that anymore.
Tell your Vanetta story. Yeah. You know, it's like...
Your turnips and Vanetta, I don't know what they... And I was like, how can someone eat a box of Mars bars? Or ice cream Mars bars? Like, you can't really do that anymore. And she went, okay, that's fine. I won't do that anymore. And I went, okay, so I would have been, you know... Anyway, the moral of the story is we have to learn how to talk about these things. Education has changed. People didn't know what protein was.
Yeah.
People, you know, still are... Now... Education has changed for the better, but unfortunately, there's too much. There's a line I'll probably get wrong. Something like we're drowning in information, but suffocating for knowledge, in a sense of there's so much stuff being thrown at us that we can't breathe. You know, and someone needs to go, don't mind this. You don't need to do that. Focus on this batch of things and learn about it. And when we educate ourselves with the right things, we can move forward. And, you know, it is there's conflicting information. Eggs are good, eggs are bad. Fat is good, fat is bad. Sugar is going to kill you, sugar won't kill you. You know, dairy's good, dairy's bad. Low fat, high protein, low protein. It's very, very conflicting. And it's, you know...
And this is probably the problem whenever you get blackguards in the space that don't really know.
Blackguards. It's a brilliant word.
It's true, though, you know what I mean?
Unfortunately, that is, you know, there's blackguards in every industry, obviously, and the problem is the blackguards are probably making the money,
but
giving you the hook, you know.
Because they're shameless and they're out there. Well, look, we always ask our guests as well for their death row dinner. So,
yeah, I mean,
box of ice cream bars.
I think you've probably the biggest appetite I've ever dined with somebody.
Really?
I've never seen anybody to eat as much food as John. He is, and you wouldn't think it. Because,
yeah, sizey am I.
But I mean, you can put a serious amount of food away.
Yeah.
So I think I know what it's going to be.
It would probably be a tomahawk steak, if I'm being honest. A big beast of a tomahawk steak. Load of roasted potatoes. Good portion of veg. A big massive glass of raw milk. I'd be happy. I'm very excited.
When he had the gym up on in number 17 up on Merrion Square, I can't remember what day it was, but I brought a couple of tomahawks up and we trained 4 or 5 lads, and then we cooked the tomahawks up and we sat on the gym floor.
Oh, deadly.
I still remember that.
Like, of all the fancy restaurants I've been in and the experiences, it was one that, like,
I was up there.
It was up there.
For me, it was
you
up
made
there.
Up a sauce.
Yeah, from chimichurri.
You made it up from like a few bits of bobs that were around the gym.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Mark had a bit of this and someone had a bit of olive oil, and all of a sudden you had this little sauce put together and.
Really steady cook.
Yeah, and like when I look at some of my fondest memories. In the last 15, 20 years, I used to live out in Wicklow and I had a little gym that I set up outside in the garden. And I remember one day of this distinct memory of barbecue and tomahawk steaks and the two lads training in the garden with me, Kev, my two brothers. And I just remember going, this is it. This is as happy as I need to be. Yeah. I don't need a fancy car and a drive. I don't need anything like that. And let's like, there's something about, you know, training together and having a meal together like that lads really love. I don't know whether that's a caveman thing or what it is, but there is, you know, it's like we've been to battle now.
Well, you earn the steak, I suppose. Yeah. It tastes nicer.
There really is, and a lot of my fondest memories of, you know, hanging out with my mates and doing, like, a lot of my friends obviously are in the fitness world, is like, let's do a workout and go and have a big steak or a burger or a whatever barbecue together. And it's that breaking bread and that shared meal thing has always been a part of my life, whether it was with my mom and my family there, the extended, you know, family I have around me. So, yeah.
What a nice way to finish a lovely conversation. So, John, look, thanks for joining us. I've been asking you to come in for ages, but I'm delighted you came in. So, nice one. Thanks a million.
Thanks.
Cheers, Sean. Good man.
Well, that was a great chat, Gaz, huh?
John's at Merchant, you've probably figured it out, but a good friend of mine and someone that I bounce off a lot of the time, not just physically. We don't just slap the head of each other, but also from
you do a bit of boxing, do you?
Yeah, well, with John, I do, with John and his brothers. We haven't, because he's moved down to Portugal, not as much.
Yeah.
But we done this thing called on a Thursday, it used to be Thursday mornings, Fight Club, where there's myself and John and four or five other lads. And like one guy was in the world of banking, I think, there was an insurance fella. I mean, what I liked about it was a space where no one was asking me anything, or like, you know, I didn't care what he worked at, or what he didn't care what I worked at. But I'll tell you this much, and you learn very quickly to keep your guard up because John gives you a dig. Know all about it, but looks a bit of fun, a bit of crack.
Love a good
very
scrap.
Safe as well. Yeah, I love a bit.
Love a good scrap. Yeah, nothing
good
like
to get
it,
you in.
Anyway, it is Culinary Conundrum time. Ed Chef, hit us with your best, sir.
How are we getting on? Yes. Thanks again to everyone for all their questions. Just give the email address. It's food@goaloudnow.com. And somebody who did that was Amber in Cork. Dear Gareth and Gary, I want to bake French onion soup, lava cakes, pot pies, etc. in the oven. But I don't have ceramic ramekins. I do have oven-safe glass Tupperware containers. Is there a difference between the two of them for performance? Any cook times I should adjust to compensate for different vessels? TIA, Amber in Cork.
So Amber, I think what you're referring to is the fact that Gary and I have spoken about the Staub and Le Creuset, and a lot of recipes called for these cast iron pans.
Yep.
And the reason why they do is because they conduct each heat very evenly. So if you're going to make a French onion soup, for example, and you want to do it in the oven, which you can, you would start it off on the stove and caramelise those ovens, where you can't do that in those glass casserole dishes.
Pyrex, yeah.
Yeah, so I would be saying to you, if it's a French onion soup that you're going to tackle, then you just need to do it in a pot, whatever pot that you own, but you're just going to have to keep an eye on it and just watch the temperature on it. Those glass casserole dishes are really good for doing different types of puddings and flans, and you can do casseroles in them. But the thing is, you'll probably, like, say if you're making a lamb casserole, for example, you'd use your frying pan to sear off all the meat to get the caramelization, and then you put that caramelized meat into that casserole dish, and then you do your veg into the casserole dish, and then you would, we've spoke about this technique loads of times, you deglaze the pan, where if you own a stob, you don't have to take stuff out, you just do it all in there, where if it's one of those glass dishes, you deglaze that pan and you pour that liquid in on top, and then you pop it into the oven. So, look, I would be saying to you, save up, or maybe your next birthday or something that's coming along. Because they really are a one-time investment. Once you buy one, you own them, that's it. Like, they don't break, so. And buy a cast iron one. There is kind of, you can get other materials in them, but it's cast iron which you're looking for.
Great. Thank you, Amber. Although I should say, what's the opposite of defence? I thought we were getting a lot of messages in from Tia, but it was people saying thanks in advance, and they put TIA, and I was like, oh, Tia's been on again.
Right, yeah.
Hello, Gareth, Gary, and Ed Chef. Big fans of the pod, and congratulations to you, Gary, on your new position with the K-Club. Can't wait to make a visit over the summer. Okay, so my conundrum, I'm new to the chutney train.
Wow.
And I made my first attempt today. It turned out okay. I'm wondering if there would be a benefit to caramelizing the onions before adding them to the apples, or will the caramelization they go through with the apples be enough? Many thanks, Brenda Daly in Kildare. Wow.
So it's an apple chutney. She's making an onion and apple chutney. Well, you got to caramelize them first for sure. Like, I mean, if you're going to be, it all depends on what you're making exactly. Like, without me kind of knowing exactly what you're making, but definitely if you're making a sweet apple onion chutney,
probably
or whatnot,
cheese or something, I'd say.
Yeah, you got to start it. And again, our friend Le Creuset or Staub comes up again, because again, you need to do something like that there as well, is it's like the depth, the heat. There's number one, the heat retention, but also things tend not to burn in these sort of cast iron pots as well. And a chutney or a jam or anything like that there, they're absolutely perfect for making it. So yeah, if you're doing it, you want to start, get a wee bit of oil, a tiny little bit of butter, depending on what your medium is, and then you'll add your onions. They'll take the longest, and they're going to hold shape a lot better than an apple. So the onions is what you're going to start with, and then you bring in the softer ingredients in. In this instance, it's the apple, and then you're probably going to be adding sugar, and you're going to be adding vinegars and different, again, depending on your recipe, but there'll be vinegar in there, there'll be sugar in there, but caramelize your onions first and then incorporate the apple.
Brilliant answer. Thank you, Brenda Daly. Final question comes in from Cork. Bye. Sorry. Can I replace white sugar with honey in a baking recipe? In the same vein, can I replace brown sugar with molasses? Would I have to adjust how much flour there is to compensate? Less butter, maybe. I know I'd get different flavours. I'm wondering if everything will bake correctly. That comes in from Carl Moynihan in Cork, by. So they want to replace, yeah.
The short answer is probably no. Yeah. So, like, depending on what you're doing, and in the world of baking, you really have to follow the recipe. Where if you are making, Gary shared a lovely recipe a few weeks ago for a chutney, and I think it called for white sugar or brown sugar. If you replaced one with other, yeah, it's grand. But if you're in the world of baking, or you're making a cake, there's a bit of science going on there. There's probably baking powder, yeah, baking soda.
Well, the sugar could be making a sambouillon with egg yolks, exactly, or whatever, and like that's just...
You could be creaming it with butter or, yeah, you know, so without knowing exactly what the recipe is, but if you're in the world of a sauce and savoury and you swap out brown sugar for molasses, it normally doesn't really matter. It'll just give a different flavour profile. But if you're baking something, the sugar or the molasses or the honey or the other white sugar could be actually doing something within the recipe. Yeah. So you can't just go, well, throw another spoonful of flour in, because then you just end up with a disaster bake, which I think has happened to every cook along the way.
Yeah. Works, in a nutshell, it works in some instances, and certainly not in others. So it'll work as a sweetener replacer in a something that's like a liquid or whatever. But in baking, where science is involved and the reason it's there, it won't.
Yeah, okay.
Great stuff. Thanks again, Carl, Brenda, and
Amber.
They're
getting quite technical, the old questions.
They're getting,
aren't
trying to catch the boys, right? You want to be up early. You'd want to be up earlier.
I love the idea of it like being a Fight Club equivalent.
Yeah.
Conundrum Club. Right, well, lads, it's going to get him this week. No.
I thought Gary was just going to answer that last question. No.
Brown sugar.
I might look like
everyone.
A ruffian, but.
Thanks to everyone. Again, for your conundrums, do send them into food@goloudnow.com.
Some show gas.
That's it. We just need to be out the gaff now, don't we?
Yeah.
We wrapped up the other show, didn't we?
You wrap it.
Well, do you want to wrap this one up? Because I actually intro John, remember?
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what I was doing there.
Yeah, sorry. I think he was...
I'd already started the wrap up.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
You made a dog bollocks of it.
Keep it in.
Gary, yeah,
let's leave it in.
All right, guys, some show.
Great stuff. I knew John was going to be an interesting character, and he has such a holistic approach to fitness. And now, don't get me wrong, he can get very strict with the diet at the start to try and get you to figure out what's going on. But, you know, really into his group, really, really into his food. And look, you figured out already, but a very good friend of mine, and as is all of his family now as well. So really good.
Yeah, I noticed that actually. You knew all of them. Yeah. Does he still do some work for the Marker?
Yeah. He's kind of like our wellness guru, if you like. So we have these kind of professionals within the business that, like, we have somebody around storytelling. We have somebody, I'm obviously the one for food. We have one for our local knowledge. So, like, our concierge is our guru that can tell you about all the different points around the city. And so only on Saturday gone there, John and I done an event with Image Magazine, and there was lots of different speakers. John done he done a fitness class with his wife, Adrian, at the start, and then it led into a load of different speeches and talks throughout the day. I sat on a panel discussion with a nutritionist and a pharmacist and me from the food side of things. So I kind of like the world of wellness at the moment. I think it's in a much better space. And that's what, like, I think this appetite for just looking a certain way is starting to fall back a little bit. And I think people are just trying to eat better and move better just to be well. And I think that's the message I like in the world of wellness. So
yeah, people wanting to feel good.
Yeah, and John is like he's literally at the very top end of his game. He's one of the best trainers in the country, and even into the global market. Like he lives over in Portugal now. So yeah, still very much my coach in a lot of areas. So good lad.
Yeah, good for him. Yeah, all right. That wraps us up. So check out at Gar Mullins or at Gazza Chef on Instagram if you want to hit us up. We're always dropping bits and bobs up there. I need to get more food up on my Instagram. I've kind of lost the run of it. I'm too busy.
Recipes actually going out this week.
I'm too busy at work, but I've got a few kind of done. I need to start sharing a wee bit more. But feel free to drop a DM if you want some content. You can sort of direct us a certain way. Like and share the pod and get your buddies involved. We're well into season 3 now, and hopefully more to come. Thank you for tuning in.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.